You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, if you've been following the news at all, and you, I'm sure you have, you may be feeling a bit uneasy because between government announcements of what the color code threat level of terrorism is to pictures of streets full of people wearing surgical masks in China and Hong Kong to try to ward off SARS to the war in Iraq, you just may be tempted to stay home because it's just too dangerous out there. Lots of people are. Just ask the airlines. But are we being too cautious? Is the perceived threat greater than the real threat? And how do you know? Joining me now to talk about the risk, about how to evaluate risk and how to deal with it, is Baruch Fischhoff. He's the Howard Hines University Professor in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences and the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fischhoff.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How closely are our perceptions of risk to reality?
What makes that a difficult question to answer is that we often don't know what reality is. So with something like SARS, which you just mentioned, where the best of science that's being applied doesn't really know how large the risk is. And so what you can fairly judge people by is whether they do a good job of tracking the evidence.
Because, you know, we're mentioning the airlines. They're just void of people flying these days, feeling that everybody, if they go anyplace, they're going to be at risk.
Well, there's a lot of reasons, why, as you know, why the airlines are down. Part of it is that the economy is down. Part of it, there are companies that have instructed their people not to fly. Other people have canceled because their family doesn't want them to go. It's not necessarily because they're overwhelmed by, they personally have exaggerated the risk. And as far as we really just don't know how big it is. I suppose if it stabilized at the rate, say, that it's been in Hong Kong over the last month. I did a back of the envelope calculation. So if we had a risk of SARS like Hong Kong has had for the last month, it would be about 350,000 cases in the United States per year and about 12,000 deaths. Well, that's like a third of motor vehicle accidents. We learned how to live with motor vehicle accidents. If you want to drive, people do it.
Right.
But what we really don't know is whether this is something that we're going to get on top of, and then, well, it's a good idea for us to have waited it out until they figured it out, or whether this is something that's going to explode exponentially. We don't really know quite yet.
What do you think about the color-coded terror warning system, which is supposedly tell us the risk out there?
Oh, I think it's hard to find a whole lot to value in that. It doesn't really. There may be some sort of signaling that's useful to professionals in the area who do different things and allocate their resources appropriately. But I think for most people, it's really hard to get any translation between that and your everyday activities. And, you know, unfortunately, because nothing is happening, I mean, we've fortunately had very little domestic terror or even incidents, at least that we know about, over the last period, we can't even do our own intuitive statistics to say, well, when it's this color, that's what it means, and when it's that color, that's what it means. It's the color changes, and the world looks relatively similar.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about risk this hour with Baruch Fischhoff. Can you give us some ideas of where, of some of the things we may be too worried about? What kind of things do we think are too risky from your experience?
Well, I think that I don't know. I find it actually tempting to criticize other people for the things that they're worried about. I think that you look, the research shows that people's risks are generally pretty well correlated with the evidence that they have at hand. And that, in fact, there's research suggesting that people almost automatically count the number of times that they see things happening. Where we tend to go astray is where appearances are deceiving. So something is overreported relative to other risks. So my wife works in child abuse prevention. I think that that's something that's underreported and people don't really know about it. But it's a matter of ignorance more than a matter of stupidity.
But you can also have instances where one society thinks there's a lot more risk at something than another. And what comes to mind about this is genetically modified foods where, you know, it's almost not to be found anywhere in Europe because they're so afraid of the risks. So here they're in all over in our food supply.
Yeah. Well, I've done some research on that. I think much of the difference in perceptions has to do with a kind of institutional failure. That is, the institutions who are responsible for these crops have tended to be viewed as more responsible, more trustworthy in this country than they have been in Europe. So if you take something where you can't really tell what the risk is to the environment, maybe a little better, there's better evidence on its risk to human health, you've got to believe somebody's theory. If you don't trust the people, then maybe you don't trust your theory. And so people, you know, legitimately judge other people by what they perceive to be the candor with which they've communicated. Doesn't mean that they're not honest people, but I think that that's the way the industry has been perceived in Europe more than in the United States.
What's your feeling about how the media in general portray events to make them feel risky or not?
Well, I think that what you find in the media, in those media that you are like your show, where the people have some experience with risks, I think you're relatively more likely to get the information to come out. And I think often actually the media are responsible for assembling the story more effectively than the authorities are. I think the media got out the story, say, on the anthrax attack in 2001, perhaps faster than the officials do. I think the media pay a lot of attention to something that has grabbed people's attention. So you could say, well, they're overplaying it. But typically the media will lock onto something that's new, and people want to learn about things that are new. They want to know whether this is a big thing or this is a big deal, this is a small deal, mm-hmm. Here's a chance to learn about it. So the fact that there's a lot of coverage in a focused period of time doesn't necessarily mean that people or the media think that this is going to be the largest risk impossible. You also have the media playing on our emotions, and that's a whole other set of processes.
Mm. Every time things get focused on, they get sort of amplified. For example, I've heard people say, you know, we have 300,000 troops in Iraq now fighting this war in Iraq, and we've had 100 deaths. And then people would say, you know, if you had 300,000 people doing anything in America, you'd have much more than that. It may be safer to be in Iraq than driving in the streets of, you know, of a modern American city.
Well, maybe as a U.S. soldier, but perhaps not as an Iraqi as an Iraqi citizen. Well, I think that I don't know that people. I'm trying to think whether we have any direct evidence on this, but I think that people don't feel threatened by the war in Iraq. Is important for other reasons besides the magnitude of the risk. The risk angle is that we don't know what it portends relative to our risk at home. The argument for going to war was that this world is so risky that this is a better gamble than letting things take their natural course. So that may be a legitimate argument, but it's not an argument that ought to give us the feeling that this is a safe, easily managed world.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Is it Dennis in Tulsa?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I had a question. I'm a clinical social worker, and a couple years ago I read some research that stated that people that watched a lot of television tended to believe that there was a greater level of danger and risk to themselves than there actually was, than was actually supported by the statistics. And in other words, they had this elevated sense of being unsafe, you know, that they were going to be a victim of crime or something like that. And I was wondering if your guest could speak to that.
An interesting question. People, you know, as I was mentioning, people are attuned to things that they see. If you see more of it, you think it's more normal. So it would stand to reason that people would have elevated feelings of risk if they are exposed to a lot of it. Methodologically, it actually turns out to be rather difficult to tell whether people are overestimating or underestimating risk. So people don't, in their everyday lives, give probabilities or estimate the numbers of fatalities in the United States from a particular source. I would want to look real hard at that study and see whether they had actually demonstrated overestimation or underestimation. It could be either way. I could have an elevated feeling and still not see just how big the problem is.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Is it possible that we do risky things and get away with them and think that therefore they're not risky anymore?
Well, we do learn from experience.
We take it, we say, well, you know, that didn't happen this time, maybe it won't happen in the future, or we just get used to it.
Yeah.
And so we ratchet up our level of risk tolerance.
Well, one of the things that turns out to be unintuitive to people is how quickly risks mount up through repeated exposure. So you do something that really isn't very risky, and you're probably going to get away with it. If you do it often enough, then it may catch up with you. And people often don't think long-term. They're just doing it once, and they don't think that they're going to repeat it. And when people try to accumulate risk, they tend to under-accumulate it. So if you think of driving without a seatbelt, your chances on an average trip of it, if it being a fatal trip, it's about 1 in 5 million, and yet in the United States, about 1 in 100 or 1 in 200 people end their lives in a motor vehicle accident. So this is a tiny risk that does mount up through repeated exposure.
Mm-hmm. I'm even thinking about the shuttle accident, where we're finding now, you know, there had been foam coming off the shuttle many times, and people investigated it, but possibly, you know, since it hadn't caused any tremendous failures before, maybe that ratchets up the idea this is not such a terrible thing, and then something happens and you finally hit the point where something bad happens.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example. And I think there's these two phenomena. One is not realizing that you keep rolling these dice and eventually they will catch up with you. And secondly, that's if the dice are the same from time to time. And second, as you were saying, the dice have actually gotten increasingly loaded against you because of a kind of normal complacency. Well, that's normal in our lives, and maybe excusable in our lives, maybe not so excusable from major institutions.
Let's go to Carl in Santa Clara. Hi, Carl. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, it sounds like you guys were just talking about what I was thinking, and that is the preventable risks that are much greater and cumulative, like solar radiation versus, like nuclear power plant radiation dangers. You know, you've got many, probably a million times more people suffering cancer from solar radiation, something they can do something about. Is there any studies about, like, they're comparing the risks of what we could prevent by our own actions versus, you know, these things that require, you know, acts of Congress?
That's an interesting question. I think one reason that you'll sometimes find people tolerating big risks and not small ones is that they sometimes get a benefit from a risk, and they'll tolerate more where they can benefit from it. So if I feel that, I don't know, the nuclear power industry is exposing me to risk for the benefit of its executives or its shareholders, and I'm not getting any benefit, I may find that an intolerable risk, even while viewing it as a relatively small one. Conversely, if something I get a lot of benefit for, I will tolerate a risk. Driving is pretty risky, and it's a risk that I think most people recognize and are willing to go with. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it also turns out that some of the seemingly best bets at reducing our risk are not that easy to do. Like if you're smoking, stopping, or if you have trouble with diet, stopping. Those are difficult things that people know they could be doing better.
Talking with Baruch Fischoff of the Howard Hines University, he's a professor in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences, and also at Carnegie Mellon on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. What about societies where you're living in danger all the time? I'm thinking of if terrorism becomes more evident here, there's terrorism in Israel all the time. Do people ratchet up there? Do they make conscious decisions about it's risky, but this is how it is? I'm just going to have to go on with my life?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that happens in societies where this goes on, I mean, people do get on with their lives. If you see the terrible situation the Iraqis have been in for all this period, they still love their children. They do the best they can under those situations. I think one of the things that makes it somewhat easier for people to get on it, to manage those situations, if they have trust in their authorities. So the Israeli authorities have had a policy for a long time of telling it like it is, even if the situation is is grim. We did a national survey in the end of 2001 and 2002, and among other things, asked people whether they endorse that kind of policy, and found that we had very strong endorsement for wanting to be treated like adults and being told what the situation is. Because if you trust the authorities, then there's an element of social solidarity because people believe the same thing, of social coordination, and you don't have to second guess everything to think of, well, are they manipulating me in order to get me to do this or that? So that's something that I think that our authorities can do to help us live through the situation, manage the situation in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Aaron in Nampa, Idaho. Aaron, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your guest if the ambiguity of the risk notification that the government gives us and maybe even the air of secrecy that the current administration seems to radiate about issues like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq might actually be heightening the level of anxiety rather than decreasing it.
Well, I don't have direct evidence, but because we're all in the experimental group. But I think that actually that follows along from what I was just saying, that if you really trust your authorities to level with you, to do a good job, to think hard about your information needs, then it's a somewhat easier situation than one where you think you're being manipulated, you think that things are being hidden from you, or that messages are being put out without really thinking about your needs. So the incident with a duct tape a week or two ago, I think that eroded public faith in our central authorities as being as doing a good job in worrying about us.
What kind of information? We only have about a minute left. What kind of experiments or research do you think you need to do to learn more about risk and social and decision making?
Well, I think actually even though I am a cognitive psychologist, I think we understand the psychology of these things, perhaps the psychological side of the solution, maybe more than the analytical side of the solution. That is, I think one always needs to begin by analyzing the facts and, several of the callers said, figuring out what are the big risks, what are the small ones, what are the things that we can do. Then you can prioritize the things to give to people. There's a lot of things that are not that hard to explain to people if you take the effort to figure out what you need to do some testing of your messages, taking advantage of the science that's out there.
All right, Dr. Fischoff, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Baruch Fischoff is the Howard Hines University Professor in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences and the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, changing gears once again to the role of forensic scientists in Iraq. What can we learn from forensic science? Well, the bodies will tell us some of the clues, so stay with us.